back to What's at Risk. I'm Mike Christian. Parade magazine survey showed just how dramatically Americans' dreams and relationships have been transformed by the current economic crisis. Everyone knows that many Americans have made significant financial adjustments in their daily lives. Out of necessity, 27% of respondents to the survey pursued extra work to make money. 80% say they've been forced to do more with less. 73% have had to make unexpected changes, and 19% have sought some form of government assistance. The recession has shaken many Americans' most fundamental beliefs about their country and their prospects for economic mobility. Only a little more than half believe that if you work hard and play by the rules, you can have a solid middle-class life. Meanwhile, 87% are worried about the future of the nation. 61% feel that they did everything right and still lost. And 65% can't believe that this happened to us today in America.
The easier looks, the harder hooks. Well, it ain't no such thing as easy money.
The results also show that many Americans are placing blame directly on politicians and CEOs for their troubles. 71% feel betrayed by the government, and 70% don't think that their leaders have dealt well with the economy. The reputation of U.S. financial institutions has taken a beating as well. 76% of respondents say they'll never trust investments the way they used to. 65% feel anger toward Wall Street, and 44% have adjusted their portfolios to reduce exposure to risk. Perhaps to avoid being blindsided again, 71% are spending more time following news about the economy, and 74% describe themselves as more politically aware than ever before. Michael Berland is an internationally recognized strategic advisor and communications consultant, and an expert in how people think and behave as consumers, voters, and decision makers. As a partner in Penn, Schoen, and Berland, the leading research-based strategic, political, and corporate communications company, he has led studies and campaigns for the world's top brands, blue-chip companies, political candidates, and entertainment clients in more than 80 countries on 6 continents.
If money talks, I wish this thing to me.
Speaking with Michael Berland, the author of How the Economic Crisis Has Changed Us, an article from Parade magazine. So it appears from reading the article that the recession, this recession, will have as great an impact on those of us that have experienced it as maybe the Great Depression had on our parents and grandparents. What inspired you to do this study?
I had always been interested in how people think and how they behave. And I had felt that it had hit so many of us. Did this fundamentally change us?
Do you think it will have that kind of an impact on us as much as the Great Depression had on that generation?
4 out of 5 of us have felt the impact. And unlike the tech bubble or the real estate recession, this has hit all of us. And so I think it will.
To me, there's sort of a sense of helplessness in the survey results. Do you see that as you look at them?
Well, there's an emotional response. It makes us feel vulnerable, angry, resentful, out of control and distrustful. But there's also some optimism in the poll.
Yeah, there's definitely optimism, but it does seem that like there's just this underlying sense of, hey, I did everything right, and here I am in this big mess, and I don't see a real way out of it.
Look, it's not good to be, we feel betrayed by the government, and we feel angry towards Wall Street.
How did you gather the data?
We did a random poll across the country, just like all the presidential polls that you'll see from time to time or published in the newspapers. You just mentioned that, you know, there's a lot of blame and anger that comes through against Wall Street and the government and everything else. Did you find many people taking personal responsibility for getting us in this mess?
They took responsibility and felt that they hadn't followed the news, that they had over-leveraged themselves, that they had extended themselves, and they had lost sort of track of some of their spending habits. And as a result of that, they've now decided to delay or cancel their vacation. Now they have to pursue extra work to make money. Americans, you know, don't always look back as much as they're forward-thinking. And so even if they get themselves into a pickle, they look forward to the future and how to get out of it.
Were you surprised at some of the results?
I was. There were a couple that really struck me. The fact that 87% were worried about the future of the nation, and you know, two-thirds had felt that they did everything right and still lost, and yet Americans still described themselves as glass-half-full people and believe that the American dream is still within reach for them and their children.
You identified in this study new political and social types that have emerged: anxious moms, Obama optimists, the gratefuls. Can you describe each of those?
The anxious moms were the ones who are really feeling the pinch. Back in the mid-90s, during the 1996 election, we would have described them as soccer moms, the ones that were ferrying their children from soccer game to soccer game. Now they're looking for jobs. And what was interesting about them is that the bitterness that they feel has started to sort of translate into issues with their relationships. And so you worry about just what the economic stress is making them feel, and how will that manifest itself as we look at the 2010 and 2012 elections.
And how about the Obama optimists?
The Obama optimists are completely on the other side of the equation. They actually enjoy the challenge of doing more with less. They're a little bit younger. They strongly supported Obama. And they are really taking this chance to create more fulfilling futures. And if you look at what Michelle Obama is doing, she's really speaking to them with her vegetable garden, kids' health, and her social entrepreneurialism efforts.
And the gratefuls?
The gratefuls are the group that they're older and it missed them. They were safer investments. They are typically empty nesters. And they are now much more appreciative of what they have.
So, you know, back to that hopeful note that you were talking about that does also come through, you know, we reached this just height of excess during this last, you know, 5 to 10 years. Do you think people feel like that it was an excess, a period of excess, and that now, as this starts to work itself out, that we really will be better off in the long term?
There's definitely a reset. Like I said, Americans don't typically look back, but there is a little bit of reflection. They are starting to volunteer for charities more. They're reading for pleasure. They become more do-it-yourself. They're doing stuff around the house. They're connecting with old friends. They're rediscovering religious groups. And they're forming stronger relationships with their spouses. They definitely can feel sort of the go-go times are over, and perhaps they did overextend themselves. And so now they're resetting a little bit.
And how do Americans view themselves and view their place in the world? We've always, you know, at least our generation has seen ourselves as leaders in the world, and this has certainly, you know, put a little bit of chink in the armor.
You know, we didn't cover that in the poll, but you definitely get a sense, if you look at all these findings, that this had a humbling effect on us. And I think if we look at the election of Barack Obama in 2008, we strongly desired change. We change in our posture, in the way that we're carrying ourselves, and the way that we position ourselves in the world. So I think if you take that election, these results, you can feel a character and demeanor change for Americans.
So, Michael, you wrote a well-received book called What Makes You Tick, How Successful People Do It. Maybe you can tell us just a little bit about that book.
Well, I was, after spending 20 years of working for top business leaders and political figures, I was always fascinated by their stories, and I wanted to share that with readers. And so I was looking for patterns of success. And the one unifying theme, whether I was talking to Dick Parsons, Mario Andretti, Heidi Klum, or Brian Williams, was there always was a period of introspection, of understanding what they find fulfilling and what they're good at. And they use that throughout their careers.
You didn't just talk to business people. You talked to successful people across the board.
Yeah, I talked to everywhere from, you know, models to athletes to political figures, and I was able to group them into four groups. I identified a group of natural-born leaders, those who enjoy managing complex situations and inspiring them. I talked to visionaries like Mark Burnett and Jake Burton, and who see things that others don't. You know, their motto is, if it ain't broke, fix it anyway, because we can do it better. I spoke to do-gooders, whose sole purpose is really to help others achieve their goals. And I talked to independent seekers, like which is the group that I fall into, who their success is really about being in control and helping situations, but it's all about achieving what's important to them.
So that period of introspection that you mentioned, was that preceded by a period of failure or a downtime for them?
No, in fact, it comes at all sorts of different. For some people, it comes early in their life, like Bob Costas, and he decides, look, I want to be a sports announcer. I'm going to pursue that. For others, like Bill Donaldson, who was the chairman of the SEC, it came when he was in the Marines. So it can come at all different points, but the key is that it comes. Like, I'll never forget a story. There's a guy named Barry Weissler who's in my book. He went on to become a very successful Broadway producer and produced the show Chicago. And he told me a story that he was at community college in New Jersey, wasn't quite sure what he was going to do with his life, wanted to be a football player. And he went and he saw a play that was going on. And at that moment, he realized he wanted to be an actor and he wanted to pursue a life in theater. And it clicks, and then he started taking the steps to do that. And I think for all of us, it's about having that moment. And they don't teach that in school, and yet it can be really so important. And then putting yourself in a position, if you're an independent seeker, don't put yourself in the role of being a natural-born leader where you're going to have to inspire and motivate hundreds of people, because it's not going to work for you. You know, your satisfaction comes from your ability to do the job, and then you're going to move on to the next one.
So you have to have a little bit of insight about what type of person you are, too.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they always say everybody can grow up to be president, and I say, why would you want to? You know, for some of us, that's a great gig. For others of us, we'd be miserable.
Yeah, no question. Michael Berland, author of What Makes You Tick and How the Economic Crisis Has Changed Us.
Since the recent H1N1 threat, hospitals are placing higher restrictions on their visitation policies. While this helps reduce exposure to viruses, it also means that patients will see less of their family and friends, increasing their feeling of isolation. CaringBridge, a nonprofit providing free websites that connect loved ones during a serious health event, is the solution to keeping patients from feeling isolated during hospital stays.
You will find beauty in the toughest of places, and I will be thinking of you out there.
Patients can create their own virtual hospital room on www.caringbridge.org. where family and friends can gather to exchange health updates, love, and support. Setting up a secure CaringBridge website takes just a few minutes. CaringBridge is a charitable nonprofit organization providing free websites that connect family and friends to share information, love, and support during a serious health event, care, and recovery. Its mission is to bring together a global community of care powered by the love of family and friends in an easy, accessible, and private way. CaringBridge saves time and energy by centralizing communication and easing the burden of updating everyone during a health event. Since 1997, more than 170,000 CaringBridge websites have been created. Although CaringBridge is primarily used during health events such as cancer, premature birth, and serious injury, it also serves as an excellent solution to any situation where physical access to hospitals and patients is restricted, says Sonia Mehring, founder and executive director of CaringBridge.
We are speaking with Sonia Mehring, the founder and CEO of CaringBridge. So since 1997, I read on your website that you've set up over 170,000 websites on CaringBridge. What exactly is CaringBridge and how does it work?
Well, my Caring Bridge is a online service at www.caringbridge.org, and it's there free for anybody to use that is going through a serious health condition or event. And it's really designed to instantly connect you to your friends and family. So when someone goes through a serious health event, has a serious health condition, one of the most important things is connecting to their friends and family, letting everybody know what's going on, and allowing those friends and family to be connected and show their support. And that's what Caring Bridge does through technology, through the Internet.
And when did you start it?
It was back in 1997.
It's
been 12 years.
And it's such a great idea, because I know that anybody that's listening that's gone through an event like that, the communication aspect of it is so important. And if you're immersed in this stressful event, sometimes it's hard to get out and have phone calls to everybody that's interested. So I think it makes a lot of sense.
Right.
What inspired you to start the site?
Well, back in 1997, which it's so interesting because now the Internet and online social networks seem to be a part of everyday life. But in 97, really, there was a whole different environment. Not everybody had Internet. In fact, many people thought it was kind of the evil thing breaking society apart. But in 1997, really good friends of mine had a very premature baby. And when I asked them what I could do to help, they said, "Can you let everybody know what's going on?" And I thought, absolutely. And I turned around and thought, how am I going to do that? But having a background in technology, I thought, you know what, I'm going to create a website. And in fact, I always say the same night their baby, Bridget, was born, that first Caring Bridge site was born. And it instantly eased the burden of letting people know what's going on. But the wow factor was the unbelievable ability to connect to that circle of friends and family and have everyone feel so connected, so involved. People were able to show their love and support to my friends, even though they couldn't directly call them, they couldn't stop by. It was just wonderful to be able to bring that level of compassion through that technology.
When and how did it evolve into your life's work? I assume it is your life's work now.
It is. Well, unfortunately, baby Bridget's life was 9 short days, but that first community that was created through Bridget was such a phenomenal event. It was one of those events in your life where you know, boy, this would be so valuable for anybody. And in fact, as we gathered for Bridget's funeral service, that was what everyone kept saying to me is, you got to make sure that this is there for others. And so very soon after that, just a couple months, Caring Bridge was launched out to the general public, and from there it's grown very organically, very word of mouth, a friend telling a friend, a family telling a family, and has really grown through where today every 8 minutes a new Caring Bridge site is created that really is connecting friends and family.
Wow, that's spectacular. How many people just sort of ballpark use the site worldwide?
Well, in the last 12 months, almost 40 million different visitors have been to, the very many different sites. So it literally is touching millions of people's of lives.
Does it cost any money for a user to set up a site?
Absolutely not. One of the most important core values when I started this was it's really there to help people in this health event, this health crisis, because it's so important. It's one of those when it matters most kind of feelings. And having said that, I knew it needed to be free, easy to use, and really somewhat protected, almost a sacred area. And those three conditions are something that lives on today. And so making sure that this is a service that is there, available to anyone who needs it, free, easy, and free of advertising, free of profit-generating type things like ads or other solicitations. So that's really what made us think, boy, this should be a nonprofit. That this is a service that needs to be there. It helps tremendously for people going through this type of situation.
So that begs the question, where does your funding come from?
Well, we are a nonprofit, like I mentioned, and so all of our funding, in fact, 90% of our funding comes from individual donations of people that have used Caring Bridge, sees that value, and knows that as they have received this value, they want to make sure it's there for others. And so through charitable contributions, Caring Bridge is supported.
Is it an interactive site? Besides just putting up the information, can people reply back and post blogs and things like that?
Right. There's several pieces of it, but at the heart of each Caring Bridge site is that journal that the patient or the primary caregiver, the author that we call them, post the journal that's going on. They can post photos. They can post links to, you know, if it's a kind of a detailed medical situation, a lot of times people will post links to additional information. And visitors not only visit and read that, but they can also post their own messages back and their own links and their own photos. So it really becomes a community. And, you know, these basic building blocks have been there since 97. So what's always fun for me is as these other social networks, as they're called today, have sprung up, is Caring Bridge was doing that 12 years ago with having these blogs, having these social networks, and they're just extremely powerful.
And how long does how long can a personal site stay active?
I think this is also something that sets us apart is really there is no time limit. Caring Bridge is there for as long as the person needs it. And in fact, many sites, we have sites that are literally 12 years old. A lot of sites they'll have either perhaps after someone passed away or like a premature baby that, you know, got out of the NICU and has gone on to school, but they really keep it as a legacy of any, you know, journey that happened. And I think that's all part of the healing process. So having Caring Bridge there for as long as they need it is our policy.
So do you have unlimited capacity in terms of websites that can be set up?
Virtually. I mean, that's something we always are striving for is what's interesting with the technology, which, and again, I'm very passionate about technology, love technology, but the challenges with technology is it's always changing. There's always something new. There's always added security, and the idea of capacity for storage, for bandwidth, for, you know, response rates continues to climb. But that is something we work so hard at every day to make sure that the people setting up Caring Bridge sites don't have to worry about that. We worry about that.
Speaking of capacity, do people post pictures and things like that to the site?
They do. We have a photo album that they can post. People also sometimes link to other things. For example, we don't have people upload videos on our site, but we have an easy link to YouTube, et cetera. So we're able to leverage those other services that are out there as well.
Do you need a lot of technical savvy to be able to set up and operate a site?
Definitely not. That's one of, again, one of our core values is this needs to be easy to use. The last thing someone needs as they're going through a stressful time in their life is, where do I click? And plus, we also have a lot of users that many times, this is sometimes the first time they've used the Internet as maybe perhaps, you know, the Aunt Edna's, if you will, that want to come in and visit their grandchild or their daughter. And so we work very hard at having it being extremely easy to use. We also have customer service that's available online and as well as in a chat situation or via the phone.
So I assume these journals are, you know, can become pretty cathartic for the people that are actually writing them. What are a couple of the more inspiring stories that you're aware of?
Well, you know, I had one mother who I met. It was actually pretty interesting. We were in a hospital kind of waiting room, and I was waiting to actually talk to a doctor, and she was there for her son, and I actually had a shirt on that had my Caring Bridge shirt on, and she said, oh, I use Caring Bridge, and we got into a conversation, and she said, so her son had a very serious condition, and she said, you know, I do not know what I would have done without Caring Bridge. You literally saved my life as a mother to be able to write down what was happening, get that support back, and it does become very therapeutic, not only for that patient who gets that love and support, but those caregivers. But it also becomes therapeutic for those family and friends that, you know, don't want to bother the person. They're able to find out what's going on and lend at least some level of support, be it even being just a message that they can leave.
What's in the future for Caring Bridge?
Well, we've reached millions of people, but what really keeps us going also every day is there is still a huge gap of awareness for Caring Bridge. Even though we get 200 to 300 sites created every single day, you know, there's thousands of people every day being diagnosed with cancer alone. So we know that we need to reach and make sure Caring Bridge is there for anybody. The last thing I want to do is hear someone say, I wish I would have known about Caring Bridge when I had my premature baby, when my friend went through breast cancer, when my father had a heart attack. So we really work very hard to make sure Caring Bridge is there for people who need it and they know about it.
Son, any final words?
Just right off of that thing of, boy, people need to know about Caring Bridge. The number one way people find out is they heard it from a friend. So I encourage anybody listening to this program, if they can think about anybody in their life, be it someone at work, someone in their church, someone, you know, in their card club, or in their own family, if they think they could be helped with Caring Bridge, tell them to go to caringbridge.org. It's free, it's easy, and it's really a gift people can give someone.
Yeah, that's great. Sana Maring, the founder and CEO of Caring Bridge, thank you so much for your time.
When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I will dry them all. I'm on your side. Oh, when times get rough and friends just can't be found, like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down.
That's it for this week's edition of What's at Risk. I'd like to thank our three special guests tonight, Peter Goodman, the author of Past Due, The End of Easy Money and the Renewal of the American Economy, Michael Berland, and Sonia Maring, the founder of Caring Bridge. I'd like to thank our producer, Johnny Pfister of Ringo Studio, and our associate producer, Scott Cooper. We're interested in what you're thinking about. Send us an email at whatsatrisk@risk-strategies.com and let us know what's on your mind. Be sure to visit the What's at Risk show library at wbz.com. Go to the Watch and Listen drop-down menu, then click on What's at Risk.
You've been listening to What's at Risk, heard every Saturday night on WBZ News Radio 1030 and streaming on WBZ.com.
Run the risk.